This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a researcher tells how solitary confinement has been used to punish Black prison inmates for political reasons since at least the 1950s. A new book traces the growth of the armed and violent white power movement in the United States. And an international tribunal finds the United States guilty of crimes against the lives and rights of the people of Puerto Rico. But first, activists in the prison abolition movement have been assessing the effectiveness of the latest national prison strike, which took place between August 21st and September 9th. Max Parthas is an internationally recognized prison slavery abolition activist, a spoken word artist, and a former co-host of the Black Talk radio program Abolition Radio. Parthas and other abolitionists say slavery was legalized for prison inmates by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. He was interviewed by Black Agenda radio producer Kyle Frazier, who asked, how did the latest national prison strike advance the cause of abolition?
What I did was would be considered as a consultant. I've studied this thing for many, many years now, and I'm considered one of the foremost experts on this particular topic. So, of course, you know, my counsel in these instances would be valuable. And I was involved in several of the prisons themselves and working with the prisoners and discussing things with them to help get their story out. What advancements have been made, in my opinion, we could see on multiple levels. Several Congress people, like a congresswoman out in New Jersey, also advanced the issues of the 10 demands from the prisoners and put that before Congress in New Jersey. Kanye West, of course, as we all know, went to the White House and talked about the 13th Amendment and put it on the president's desk, which was in itself historic. You may not like the messenger, but the message certainly got on the president's desk. And also, there's a lot of talk now about prison reform. And, you know, I'm not a prison reformist, but I have to be honest. I've been working on this for a long time. So everything I'm doing really is a case of reforming to try to end slavery. It may not even end in our lifetime. So I think that instances like that that we have clearly seen have made a big impact. For instance, with the Kanye West circumstance, millions of people, I mean tens of millions of people all over this country talked about the 13th Amendment probably for the first time in their lives.
No doubt. And given your functioning as a consultant, as you put it, what do you see as those examples of development from experience of putting these kinds of actions together, organizing and facing repression and coming up with new ways to get their issues on the table?
Yeah, as you know, we go back a long ways. For instance, we have been speaking with members of the Free Alabama movement now since back in 2015. And around that time, I guess 2013 and 2015 is when the abolitionist movement really started getting a push. And prisoners on the inside started seeing this as an opportunity to really get justice for themselves, because many are falsely incarcerated or over-incarcerated. And we all know how the prison system works and also how the justice system works. So you're talking about a system that has 95% plea bargain rates, and it's 95% white prosecutors. So it's just open for any kind of extreme instances that you can imagine. So this came to them as a really eye-opening event. And it goes back even further than that, because Assata Shakur, in her autobiography, explained how she learned about the 13th Amendment, because a prison guard told her about it while she was in prison. And the very first thing she said was, well, that explains a lot of things. And that's the type of feeling that everybody gets when they first find out and start understanding that at the root of all this is legalized slavery. Everything they're doing is legal, just like everything that the Germans did was legal, just like all the genocides against the Native Americans were legal. But if we're in a land of laws and the Constitution is the supreme law, well, that gives us a very big tool to work with now towards the goal of liberation and freedom. And speaking with those in the prisons out in Louisiana and Angola and also in Texas and also in Alabama and in New Jersey, they all started saying that this is something they could add to their toolkit and unify behind. And that extended beyond the prisons, because everybody on the outside was like, wow, if we can unify, I mean, what better thing to unify under than ending slavery? So I saw that grow like that and be used in so many ways. For instance, one of the victories that we recently had was in Alabama, where a for-profit probation company had 115 offices throughout the state. They were charged with RICO charges and found guilty and then forced to leave the state of Alabama. We're talking about 115 offices were forced to leave Alabama. And those are the type of victories we've seen that have come from this eye-opening understanding of the 13th Amendment.
Yes, and to build off of that, because the Free Alabama movement, as you mentioned, has been employing this language around the 13th Amendment and legalized slavery. Many other groups and individuals on the inside recognize the 13th Amendment and its consequences. What do you think it is that is creating this barrier to people on the outside coming to the conclusion that heads on the inside already recognize around prison slavery?
Well, see, that's the difference between an abolitionist and a reformist. An abolitionist sees this as a crime against humanity, and hence we call it slavery, just like the Constitution calls it slavery. We think of it as a crime against humanity. We act in accordance with the idea that it is indeed a crime against humanity. Whereas reformists don't do that because they don't dare. Many of them would be held accountable for their participation in a crime against humanity. So we're talking about, if our charges are true, then the Department of Justice, the Supreme Court, the President, the Congress, the Senate, all should be held responsible for crimes against humanity. So you can imagine they would fight against that, particularly the for-profit private prisons who, through their greed and expansion, also influenced the state and federal and county jails and prisons to do the same thing. So they're going to fight against it. As a matter of fact, we've already met some opposition. They sent the head of the history department in out of Howard, Darrell Scott, to come after us and try to disprove what we were talking about, coming out talking about we're misrepresenting history. But he shot himself in the foot when he said to me that convict leasing wasn't that bad because it wasn't as many people who were enslaved. I was like, dude, if you're saying that it's not enough slaves to be worried about, you've already shot yourself in the foot as a historian. So I think that this whole concept of fighting through a constitutional battle, particularly in a time when we have a convention of states right around the corner that could happen any month now, where 34 states have finally come together to decide they want to open up the Constitution for reinterpretation to add new amendments, that's right around the corner. We'll never see an opportunity like this again. It's like the stars are all aligned. So I think everybody's starting to see that and working towards that goal. Unification is always going to be difficult, and there is always going to be opposition, particularly when the opposition has billions of dollars and controls the media.
And speaking of opposition, we know that there has been intense repression, especially for those who have been identified as leaders organizing on the inside. So yes. Could you just discuss what kind of retaliation you've seen and any updates on the conditions of heads that are inside facing that kind of repression and retaliation for organizing?
Yes, I can. And this also explains somewhat why I said I prefer to be viewed as counsel. Be your own leader. They kill leaders. They kill organizers. They put them in prisons. You know what I mean? You're capable of leading yourself. All you got to do is think about it. And we can all be leaders together of ourselves. And that's how I'm looking at it. In any case, there was widespread oppression after and during and before the strike itself. We had people who had spent time in solitary confinement since the last strike in 2017, now for over a year because they were organizers. Many of those organizers inside the prisons were immediately put into solitary confinement for no reason at all. Others were beaten, according to the reports that are finally coming in now after these few months, and they'll still keep coming in, I'm sure, for months later. But prisoners have been beaten, they've been abused, they've had their rights and their personal belongings and everything like that denied to them. Some prisons went on entire lockdown, a whole prison went on lockdown with no explanation whatsoever as to why. And this happened at least in four different prisons. We even heard from Nova Scotia's prisoners who were in solidarity there that they went through the same things. They're reporting that all the organizers there were put into solitary confinement. When I first started talking with the brothers and sisters about this circumstance, that's the first thing I pointed out to them. You could get killed doing this. You could spend 5 years in solitary confinement. You could never again have access to anything that you have access now to. You need to understand that. And they came in knowing the risk that they were taking. We all remember what happened in Attica, which is why the strike ended on the anniversary of Attica Uprising. So there's been a lot of repression, a lot of violence. I can report on four instances where people who shared Facebook posts from within the prison got a year for each Facebook post. And we're talking about some of them got 30 years, 40 years, 27 years added to their already long sentence over Facebook posts helping to organize.
And given that the attention around these issues has increased in these corporate news outlets, what do you see as the dangers of that kind of exposure, which of course, heads on the inside, abolitionists have been vying for some time to get these issues out there. Now that they're starting to become a part of the broader conversation, what are some of those hazards that you're looking out for and that abolitionists and advocates should defend against?
Well, you know, the reason that we still have slavery today is because our ancestors got hit with the okey-doke on the 13th Amendment. That exception clause was something that none of them realized would have the damage done that it did. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until 26 years later that Frederick Douglass went in 1888, I think it was 26 years, went to 1888 on the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation in Washington, D.C., and denounced it as a fraud. It took him that long to figure it out. He had to travel through the states to see the convict leasing, and he wrote on convict leasing and what was happening in that. So what we have to be concerned with more than anything else is another okey-doke, because it happens like every 50 years. We rise up, the dragon wakes up, starts breathing fire, everybody starts running scared, and then they give us some tokens, things that we might appreciate, but really do nothing in the long run. And then we go back to sleep, and another 50 years we come back. Stay away from those okey-dokes. Pay attention to what people are saying. If somebody comes out and says, okay, here's what we present to you to solve this problem, just like they did in 2015 with the Justice is Not for Sale Act, which would have banned private prisons from the United States of America. And it was presented by Bernie Sanders, of course. But see, Bernie Sanders played us for fools because he gave to us that bill like it was a bone to shut us up. And I say us because I was directly involved with lobbying him. I met with them, with his managers, with his state managers, and his national managers, and we discussed these issues with that presidential nominee. So they gave us the Justice is Not for Sale Act, and they never supported it. Not once did they even say it existed. They knew it would fail in the House. So it was just a bone thrown at us to shut us up. Don't let them shut you up. And also, don't let them use any more okey-dokes on you. Always remember what you're fighting. Slavery. A crime against humanity. If we start forgetting that, we're going to run into a lot of problems. And you got to remember, again, this nation has had a civil war over this issue. There's people out here murdering people in the streets right now. These sociopathic racists are killing people. Remember what we're dealing with. It can get much worse. So pay attention to what's happening around you.
And in the near future, especially with these elections coming up, there are some initiatives that people locally can address these issues through. Are there any of those in particular that pertain to questions of abolitionism that you would like to highlight?
Absolutely. There are a number of ways that we're hitting this from every angle. One of them, for instance, would be Colorado's Amendment A, which came after Amendment T, happened last year. And Amendment T just like Amendment A, was meant to take the exception clause for slavery out of their state constitution. Well, they only lost getting it done by just like 1% last year, and this year it's expected to pass. So if you're in Colorado, you can set precedents right now to have Colorado be the first state to take this pro-slavery language out of their state constitution. And there's 24 states in this nation that has that in them. Some are much worse than Colorado's, like Georgia, that says you can become a slave not only for conviction of a crime, but also for contempt of court. So that's the first thing. Colorado Amendment A. If you're not in Colorado, tell somebody in Colorado to vote Amendment A. And then also in Florida, there's a fight right now to restore voting rights to ex-felons, people that are on probation, parole, all of these things. That's a large chunk of the population. And in Florida, 1 in 5 black men cannot vote, even if they wanted to. That's outrageous. So they're moving to give these rights back to people in Florida. And there's also voter initiatives across the country trying to do the same thing. So keep your eyes out for those. But those would be the two that I would point out right off the top.
And finally, what do you see as the most important next steps as regards abolitionism in the U.S. and advocating for imprisoned human beings?
What we can do is very much limited until we can remove the protection to slavery from state and federal constitutions. It's very limited because right now it's protected. You know, these are workforces that they use all across the country, making goods and services provided to for-profit corporations, international corporations. You know, that's all protected by the Constitution, the federal Constitution and the state Constitution. So we got to focus on at least setting precedents, get Colorado free of that. And then we can work from there. Maybe we can get other states to follow suit. I know at least 6 states right now have tried or either pushing the same issue in their area. So let's concentrate on taking away the protection to slavery so we can fight it and defeat it state by state if we have to. Let's get the rights to people who have been disenfranchised, all of these men and women who right now have taxation without representation. Let's get them their rights to vote back. And then we can form some sort of bloc to start moving in political arenas, maybe an abolitionist party instead of a Democratic Party or Republican Party or a Green Party, an abolitionist party. So we all know what's at the top of our list to things to do. So that's what I would suggest at this point. Focus on those things. And always remember, right now there's still prisoners. I can't even call them prisoners. There's incarcerated citizens who are living through hell. And every moment that we take trying to get things done, somebody is being brutalized or murdered or killed or you name it, every second. So time is so short. Let's get it together.
That was prison abolition activist Max Parthas. A new book shows that at least as far back as the 1950s, prison officials have used solitary confinement as a political punishment against black inmates. Brittany Friedman is a professor of sociology at Rutgers University and author of the new book, Solitary Confinement and the Nation of Islam.
The essay that I wrote with Zach is coming from my larger book project, where I'm trying to actually show that in general, when it comes to forms of extreme punishment behind bars, African Americans have long been the subject of these tools of discipline and have long been systematically segregated using methods such as indeterminate sentencing in solitary confinement. And what I'm really trying to show is how solitary confinement used in this manner, it wasn't exactly called that in the beginning. It sort of evolved to be that.
Well, what was it called and how did it evolve?
Initially, and my knowledge is about California, but I am extrapolating from California to make these larger claims. So in California specifically, in 1953, the director of corrections, his name is Richard McGee, he is proposing that California prisons need to come up with some way to deal with what they're calling problem inmates. And at the time, they are defining problem inmates as those who are exhibiting what they see as psychotic behavior. And we know this is very subjective, right? So this is how it ends up being used against African Americans. Because it's like the psychotic behavior initially is people who, they call them people who are unable to cope with reality, who are having outbursts, essentially having behavioral issues. broadly defined. And broad is key here because that allows them to actually extend this to all types of behavior. And so this is as early as 1953. And finally, in 1954, California first starts building the separate wings within prisons, and they're called adjustment centers. It's just like it sounds, it's adjustment centers because they're trying to adjust the behavior of those they see as problems. But the issue, and that what I take up with in my essay, is to show that even though they were trying to use rehabilitation as the model for adjustment centers, it wasn't meant to be solitary confinement. What ends up happening as early as 1958 is the Department of Corrections starts using adjustment centers to, quote, rehabilitate African Americans who are, in another quote, politically radical, first targeting the Nation of Islam. It only takes about 3 to 4 years before adjustment centers actually translate into solitary confinement, whereas before it was supposed to be all of this programming. It wasn't even focusing on politics per se, was actually trying to focus on people that they saw as mentally ill.
So solitary confinement was initially used to deal with troublesome inmates under the guise of them being mentally disturbed. And it took a while before this became a kind of political tool of the prison administrations.
Yes, in terms of history speak, 3 to 4 years is a very short time, and they quickly broaden it. So initially, you have what they're calling just psychotic inmates. By 1958, they have a whole list of people who fall under the problem banner. So it goes, it's psychotic inmates, behavioral problems, erratic inmates. And so what the behavioral problem category is what's used against what I would call self-described Black militants. And I say self-described because I also do interviews with people who are formerly incarcerated, and they use that identifier very proudly. And so Black militant prisoners were placed under this behavioral problem category because it was broad enough that they could sort of sweepingly accuse those involved in political movements of being a behavioral problem. And that's how most of them were labeled. So in their files, it would say behavior problem will be sent to adjustment center, and then indeterminate sentence was also placed in their file. And that's what ends up becoming solitary confinement, because in the rule books on how the adjustment centers were run, which I have in my possession, thankfully, so they can't dispute this. In the rule books, it says that they are going to use indeterminate sentences because they need to be able to decide when someone is, quote, rehabilitated from their behavioral problem. And as we know, history has shown us in California that for Black militant prisoners, indeterminate really means indeterminate. They were never going to see the light of day as soon as they were put in solitary.
You write that for a time, all Black militants in prison were thought to be Black Muslims.
Yes, this is true. I have numerous documents, and when I say documents, I'm meaning memos between corrections officials in Sacramento. So this isn't just coming from wardens. So there's no way the Department of Corrections can say, you know, this is something we didn't control. This is coming from individual wardens and people within each prison. It actually is coming from the top down. They were very concerned about the Nation of Islam and very concerned that militants in general were Muslim, and that translated into violent behavior that they needed to police and segregate.
And of course, the most famous former prisoners or prisoners who died in prison in the California system were Eldridge Cleaver and George Jackson, who became a Panther leader in prison in the late 1960s. Did the administration consider them to be Black Muslims, or had they moved on in their political sophistication by that time?
They actually, by that time, were pretty stagnant in their understanding of the ideological and political differences between various Black groups. They actually, and I believe that part of this was on purpose, right? Because if you are able to be very broad and sweeping in your claims, then it allows you to sweep up a larger group of people when you decide to lock them up and throw away the key, essentially. You need to have a broader standard in order to justify your actions. If you're too narrow, then it doesn't allow you to exhibit the same type of lasting control.
The term of art nowadays, we learn among law enforcement and the political police, is Black identity extremists. Is that term at work within the prison gulag?
The term extremist is. But in this time period, they're using militant to have that same meaning. But I see a direct extension of these former ideologies, these former punishment ideologies, or if you will, punishment mindsets, which is essentially an approach to punishment, that a logic to your behavior. At this time is when you see the development of the strong focus on punishing what they are calling extremism or radicalism. And we see the extension today in society. And when I say really focusing on it, I mean in prison. Because we do know that historically, we can go all the way back to Marcus Garvey. And if you want to go before that, as you know, you can go all the way back to the slave revolts when talking about policing what's considered extremism or opposition. But what I'm showing is that in prison, it directly correlates, this focus correlates to the civil rights movement and the later Black Power movement.
Researchers tell us that at any given time, there are perhaps 100,000 U.S. prisoners in solitary confinement, which is, of course, has been documented as a violation of international law. Is this a kind of political gulag within the gulag?
Yes, it is, because I would say that whether it be in the form of correctional officers or corrections or the police, knowledge amongst African Americans or Black Americans has been identified as dangerous because it is seen as enlightening people about the conditions that led to their incarceration. And education gets us beyond this false American dream notion where you're incarcerated because strictly because of your actions and strictly because you are a bad person, right? And so it is a political tool. If you lock someone in solitary, you are effectively trying to silence them because you realize that they cannot be in the general population. And that is why Black prisoners are disproportionately placed in solitary, even relative to our disproportionate size within the prison population. We're already more represented in the prison population, but even taking that into account, we're even more represented in adjustment centers, in supermax, and I see it as a form of repression to silence us.
The pretext used by prison officials for placing so many people in solitary confinement is gang association. Are you saying that that is sometimes a euphemism for political activity by the inmate?
Oh, it most definitely is. And I know this from the archival data, and I know this from my interviews with former prisoners, and I also know this from I did an interview with a retired member of the Department of Corrections who actually worked on the gang task force. He was a part of this era in the 70s and 80s when they're actually developing this security threat group logic for identifying people and validating them. And he said that it was very arbitrary before that era. Very arbitrary. Many things they could use and to put you in solitary. But the issue they were having is that people started suing and started saying, you're putting me in solitary, there's no reason for me to be here. So they needed to develop a system that appeared to be efficient, and it appeared to be colorblind, and it appears that it's systematic and scientific versus actually being prejudicial. And so in order to do that, they needed to have three pieces of evidence. That became the standard. If we have three pieces of evidence, then there's no way you can say that we are repressing you or to put you in solitary. We actually are using a system that is just based on rules, right? It's just a bureaucracy based on rules. And that's the way that they were able to sort of try to get around a lot of the lawsuit, the early lawsuits for identifying people and putting them in solitary.
During the Obama administration, with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, we heard a lot of talk about prison reform, but most of it was about shortening sentences. And we didn't see a lot of agitation about the spread and the political uses of solitary confinement.
We don't see that because I think that for politicians even those who are identified as belonging to the left, or what I would call the more progressive left, I think that for them, tackling solitary is a dicey issue for them, right? Because it's easy for the general public to sort of get alarmed and say, well, you know, aren't they there for a reason? Aren't they dangerous? Aren't they violent? I think that I'm not saying that tackling sentencing is easy, but I think that politically it is easier than talking about the conditions of confinement versus talking about the unequal incarceration and punitive sentencing of particular sets of groups.
But of course, it's not just about the conditions of confinement. It's about the political posture and intentions of the state, the people they're prosecuting, as well as jailing, as well as putting in solitary.
Exactly. That's spot on. I think for them, for politicians, if you will, I think it's sort of a political time bomb. If they actually try to interrogate the real reasons why there's so many people disproportionately of color in solitary, and how the state has used these various identifiers and categories that they have constructed on the basis of some sort of threat to target people. I think that it's just too dangerous, if you will, for politicians to do that. And that's why a lot of the work in this area that's meaningful is coming from activists that are on the ground, and it's coming from prisoners themselves who feel like they have nothing to lose. And it's coming from, I would say, activist-involved academics versus those that are just talking from the ivory tower, those that are actually involved in communities and trying to make a difference with their work.
And are these kinds of academics becoming more numerous or less?
I like to think that they are becoming more numerous, maybe not more numerous, but I think that they're becoming more vocal in sort of the public media. I will say that. I think there's been a longstanding tradition of a subset of academics that are very active with their work outside of the academy, but I think that they may not have, either they didn't have a voice to speak out, or they shied away from it. And I do think that that's changing for the better.
That was author Brittany Friedman at Rutgers University. Kathleen Ballou teaches history at the University of Chicago and is author of a new book that puts the recent killings of Blacks and Jews in historical perspective. Ballou's book is titled Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America.
That's right. I study the history of the White Power Movement from 1975 to 1995, so covering the period from the end of the Vietnam War through the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building. Those years are important because they marked a real change in how this movement organized its activism. Most importantly, it's a shift from earlier incarnations of the Ku Klux Klan to a much more coordinated war against the federal government and other enemies, which, as you say, include Jewish people, people of color, other people that this movement sees as traitors. One of the things that has happened in the historical archive that you can see when you have this vast repository of material to look at is that events that seem random often have deep ideological connections with one another and deep social movement connections with one another, such that targets are shared in common and you can trace sort of the web of connections between white power activists by looking at the violence and the people who have carried it out.
So you can identify where these attacks come from by what the social movement says and does, even though these perpetrators may seem to be disconnected.
That's right. And this is the tricky part about working as a historian with these materials. So as I say, my study ends in 1995. That is largely because the kind of archival records you need to trace out the connection between these violent events in real time isn't available to historians until decades afterward. There are other people who have that kind of information right now, including some undercover reporters, as well as government agents and monitoring agencies. That kind of undercover connection, the underground of the movement, is what we typically don't perceive at the time. So during the period of my study, what you can see is two different spheres of activism. One is public facing. So in the period of my study, it included things like public rallies, running for office, political campaigns, poster drives, white student union activity, and things like that. While at the same time, the same activists were involved with an underground of fomenting violence, assassination, obtaining stolen military weapons and materiel, and on and on and on up to the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, what we can see right now is mostly the public-facing part of this activism. So you can think about the altercation at Charlottesville, the sort of public-facing alt-right demonstration at Berkeley and elsewhere as sort of events that are intended to be perceived. The historical archive indicates that we should also be paying attention to whether there might be a violent underground that we can't see, but that is deeply connected to what's happening in public.
Yes, your studies go back to the Vietnam War era, which most of us associate with the growth or the reconstitution and expansion of left-wing activities. But you document a similar expansion of activities on the right.
That's right. And I think this is something historians missed for a number of years, largely because the left-wing activism sort of bore fruit so early, whereas the right-wing activism tended not to until a bit later. But historians have now come to understand the genesis of the broader New Right movement in both World War II and Vietnam, and the sort of current of feeling of betrayal and anti-statism, which is interesting because it's coming even from the state by the 1980s. As sort of a organizing principle that could bring together different right-wing elements of U.S. society and culture. And now I should be clear here, I'm not talking only about the white power movement, but about right-wing activism in general and the mainstream new right that we're thinking of as a grassroots surge that results in the election of President Reagan and sort of the turn to social movement politics in the 1980s and 1990s. So what I'm looking at is how alongside that, a very small fringe group was also fomenting violent racist action in a period that we've usually thought of as kind of on the left as post-racial or multicultural and on the right as colorblind. So my book is about where overt racism went in the period that we thought as a nation we had begun to move past issues of race.
In the news media, we are led to believe that the perpetrators of the racist violence are, well, deplorables, folks who have not adjusted to society, as if they are not part of some larger grouping.
Yes, and there are several reasons for this. One is that the white power movement itself has done a lot of work to confuse things in this regard. Beginning in 1983, it adopted a strategy called leaderless resistance, which is basically what we think of today as cell-style terrorism. It's the idea that you can use strong cultural communications and rhetoric to coordinate the actions of seemingly disconnected people who will then carry out acts of violence in groups of like, you know, 1 to 12 people. And this sort of came out actually of the third era Klan, which was the KKK that opposed the civil rights movement, which was heavily infiltrated by government informants. And people in the white power movement got so frustrated with this that leaderless resistance was one way to get around the idea that there are informants everywhere. The idea that one informant would only take down a cell of people instead of the whole thing. The other obvious repercussion of leaderless resistance, of course, is that it stymies court prosecutions because it's difficult to prove ties between leadership and foot soldiers. But the bigger sort of, I mean, almost unintended consequence of leaderless resistance as a strategy has been that it has obscured public understanding of the movement itself. Because what we get are, in the understanding held by sort of the broad public, journalists, jurors, prosecutors, the military, over and over again, people treat this as one-off events or lone wolf violence or the acts of a madman or a few madmen working together, when in fact there are coherent political ideologies and deep social relationships that tie these acts and these activists together.
If we approach these violent white power advocates as part of a social movement, what should our demands of power be? And how do we avoid joining with those who want the FBI and the rest of the national security state to increase its surveillance and its infiltration of all social movements in the United States, including social movements among Black people and progressives and the rest of the left?
That's an excellent question, particularly given that the force of the surveillance state has been so disproportionately targeted against the left, while the right has been sort of treated with a sort of complicity and willful ignorance over and over again. I think that one thing that is deeply, deeply important to do that doesn't have to do with surveillance is simply working to correct the public understanding of what this is. So when we look at an event like the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, it is still largely reported as an act of anti-Semitism. And I don't question that. It clearly is an act of anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism has its own history, its own set of interpretive tools that we can employ, and on and on and on. But if we treat it as an act of anti-Semitism only, we miss the way that it is connected to all of those other acts of violence that you used to open this conversation. And we see just from a simple look at the alleged gunman's social media that this was an act of white power violence. And we know that because in addition to anti-Semitic creed, he's posting all kinds of things about neo-Nazi symbology. He's posting all kinds of things about anti-immigration rhetoric. And he refers over and over again to the idea of the endangered white people, our people, he says over and over. Now, when we see that kind of rhetoric, it's our duty to think about how this all connects together such that we as a society can respond to what it is. That anti-Semitism is linked to racist violence, is linked to anti-feminism, is linked to anti-immigration rhetoric. It brings together the people who are working and struggle to face this violence.
Is there a direct political line, if not organizational line, between the rise of Donald Trump and before him Newt Gingrich and his Contract on America and other political groupings in previous historical epochs and what we saw in Pittsburgh and Kentucky and in other places over and over and over again?
This is a difficult thing to think through because I think I and most of us would not want to paint with the same brush the supporter of a mainstream conservative worldview with the people that I'm writing about who inhabit a radical political fringe dedicated to the overthrow of the state. But I think what we can do is use the way we think about social movements to understand how ideas move between fringe and mainstream. So if you think about a contemporary social movement, I'll use white power just as our talking example. You can think about it as a series of concentric circles. And in the middle, there's a group of very, very dedicated, hardcore activists, right? It's like 25,000 people, a tiny group of people per population of the United States. Those are the people who marry within the movement, they live and breathe within the movement, they dedicate their lives, right? Outside of that, there's a bigger group of, say, 150,000 people who aren't so dedicated as that inner circle, but they attend rallies, they buy the newspaper, they send contributions. Outside of them is a bigger circle of, say, 450,000 people, and I'm talking again about the 1980s. That bigger circle doesn't buy the newspapers, but they read the Klan newspapers. So we can imagine this going on and on, right? That outer circle is where historians usually draw the line between what is and is not the white power movement. But outside of that outer circle, we can imagine that there is another ring of people who would never buy a Klan newspaper, but who might agree with the ideas presented in one, particularly if they're presented by a friend over the dinner table, right? It goes on and on like that. You can think about how this works to send ideas outward and also how it works to pull people in from the sort of mainstream into these deepening levels of involvement in white power radicalism. The other thing to think about is that we do have a historical example of how this works within thinking about how white power ideas move into political parties. And I'm thinking about David Duke's presidential campaign. So if you look at his presidential campaign in the late 80s, many of the planks of his platform, one sociologist has documented, end up in the Pat Buchanan platform, which is extreme, but perhaps not overtly white power in the same way, right? And then many of the planks of that platform end up in the George H.W. Bush platform, and that one makes it into mainstream politics proper. So you can think about the way that these ideas really do have an impact on our mainstream political life in multiple and overlapping ways.
And could you describe the essence of the ideology that agitates and moves this white power movement in its various iterations?
Sure. So in the period of my study, what I'm looking at is this post-war narrative of the Vietnam War that worked to bring people together into the white power movement. They used a betrayal of authority as a story to bring together Klansmen, neo-Nazis, racist skinheads, radical tax protesters, white separatists, and others who sort of began to believe that the government was the seat of trouble. They were motivated often by what they called the Zionist Occupational Government, or ZOG, which is a conspiracy theory that alleges that Jews are secretly controlling internationalist Jews are controlling the banks, the UN, the United States government at the federal level, etc. And this met with several religious ideologies that were white supremacist in the 1980s as well, including Christian identity, which is one of the themes also that appears in the Pittsburgh shooter social media, that holds that whites are the true lost tribe of Israel, while people of color and Jewish people are supposed to be descended from Satan or from animals. This is important not only because the rhetoric it presents is so totally dehumanizing, but also because Christian identity foretells a coming apocalyptic end of the world where white people are supposed to take up arms and clear the world of non-white populations before Christ can return. So it turns racial violence into a holy war. These ideologies and how they rise and fall within the white power movement are always sort of flexible and interchangeable. And you see a great degree of opportunistic activism across the life of this movement, where people move between belief systems, between groups over the course of their time in the movement. And also, as I said, that is referring really to the post-Vietnam War period. I think that to look at what's happening now will take a larger archival study that won't be possible until we get the documents released in another several decades.
Yes, which of course begs the following question. Do you think that the current political environment encourages the spread or diminution of the white power movement?
You know, I it's an interesting question for many different reasons, not least because the last time white power turned revolutionary was during a time of conservative executive power. They made that turn in 1983 in the second term of the Reagan administration, when they arguably had a lot to gain from the state and from kind of mainstream activism. But because activists saw a gap between what the state had promised them and what the state could in fact deliver, they saw Reagan's moderation as a piece of evidence that they couldn't achieve what they wanted through electoral politics, and instead they needed to declare race war. Now, when we look at, again, the social media feed of the alleged Pittsburgh shooter, one of the things that stood out to me is his sort of disavowal of Trump and his ridicule of people who believed that Trump would be sufficient to bring around the kind of changes that they wanted. So I see some corollaries there that are very concerning. And I think the historical archive has a lot to teach us about how society can better confront this kind of violence. The hopeful thing, I think, is that in the wake of these events, I do think there is a difference in the kind of conversation the American public is having about this than at any other point in history. The events that I talk about in Bring the War Home were all reported at the time. They appeared on the front pages of major newspapers. They appeared on morning news magazine shows, and even in one memorable case, Saturday Night Live sketch. So they were known, but there wasn't this sense of conversation about white power as an organized social movement that we've begun to have in the aftermath of Charlottesville and other acts of violence in the recent past. I find that to be a hopeful thing because I do think that public understanding, juror education, investigative education, and simply people having an awareness of what this is would represent a fundamental change to how this movement is able to operate and carry out and plan violent events.
That was historian and author Kathleen Belew. A People's International Tribunal put the United States government on trial for crimes against the people of Puerto Rico, an island country seized by the U.S. 120 years ago, which was recently ravaged by a deadly hurricane. The People's Tribunal verdict was read in New York City.
The International Tribunal on U.S. colonial crimes against Puerto Rico having met in open session as guests on unceded Lenape indigenous land on October 27, 2018, having heard testimony regarding the history of U.S. colonial rule over Puerto Rico since 1989, and having heard testimony from experts, eyewitnesses, colonial resistors, and survivors, the majority of whom were born in Puerto Rico and continue to endure colonial depravity there, on the catastrophe endured by the Puerto Rican people both during and in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Having viewed videotape interviews and examined other documentary material on these topics, we hereby find the U.S. government guilty of the following crimes against humanity, warranting all measures of relief and redress, including but not limited to reparations. One, that it has deprived the people of Puerto Rico of their right to self-determination, a violation of international law. Two, that after buying Puerto Rico from Spain in 1989 without the consent of the people of Puerto Rico, it subdued popular resistance through military conquest, set up and maintains a settler colonial regime. Three, that this colonization of the Puerto Rican people took place over a century, during which independence movements were repressed with great bloodshed. Four, that the passage of Law 600 by the U.S. Congress in 1950, ostensibly allowing Puerto Rico to draft its own constitution and its official status renamed Commonwealth, known in Spanish as Estado Libre Asociado or Associated Free State, effectively legalized U.S. colonialism and created a veneer of legitimacy to what was and remains the subjugation of the Puerto Rican people. Number five, that this colonial imposition has profoundly and detrimentally impacted every area of life in Puerto Rico, from its domestic policies to its external relations, resulting in intergenerational psychosocial trauma. Number six, that this colonial imposition has included theft of land for U.S. military bases and exercises that have contaminated the soil, air, water, resulting in widespread diseases, health deterioration, and death, as well as destruction of wildlife and domestic farm animals, that it has further resulted in forced displacement, dispossession, loss of homes, and exile. Number seven, that this colonial imposition through the so-called Fiscal Control Board is directly responsible for the distrust conditions still existing in Puerto Rico more than a year after Hurricane Maria, in which the U.S. corporations and banks, under the guise of helping with reconstruction, have expropriated billions of public dollars, creating a humanitarian crisis. Number eight, that this colonial imposition has used the hurricane as a pretext to further the long-lasting neoliberal and right-wing policies of the U.S. government to privatize fundamental social services and destroy labor movements, especially in the fields of education and electricity. Number nine, that the U.S. government imposed protocols that allowed and encouraged corporate looting of Puerto Rico's natural resources and wealth and the exploitation of Puerto Rican labor, dispelling the myth and legend that Puerto Rico owes the U.S. government anything. In fact, the extraordinary debt is owed to the Puerto Rican people by the U.S. government, by U.S. corporations. Number 10, that the U.S. has committed genocide against the Puerto Rican people, including decades of sterilization of Puerto Rican women, medical experimentation, suppression of Boricua culture, exploitation of Puerto Rican youth to fight imperialist wars, denial of basic human needs, including water, healthful food, a refusal of international humanitarian and solidarity aid from various nations such as Cuba, Mexico, and Venezuela following Hurricane Maria. Therefore, we find the U.S. guilty. And we hereby demand the following. One, the U.S. government acknowledges and apologizes aforementioned crimes against the Puerto Rican people. Number two, the U.S. surrenders all property and power forcibly taken from the Puerto Rican people. And number three, the U.S. pay reparations to victims of crime of colonization. We want to thank all people for offering their testimonies here today, and this is our offering for you guys. Thank you. ¡Que viva Puerto Rico libre hoy y siempre!
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.